Digital twins are a pretty old concept. They're relatively new in healthcare, but they've been around for quite some time. And the concept behind a digital twin is that tracking physical assets is not as easy as people think, right? When you're a smaller energy company, you have a few oil wells, a few kind of refineries and a logistics network. But as you grow, that goes from 1,000 to 100,000 to like 1 million oil wells really quickly. And these oil wells are extracting oil. They're part of your lifeblood and your network. And, you know, before that, using digital twins, what they would do is they send engineers to every one of them. They go to a well, the well's fine. Okay, go to the next one and figure out. And they're like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And so what they started doing is they put in control architecture in these oil wells, talk about RPMs, heat, how, you know, the flow through of crude oil. And they reported it into a central location. And by reporting it all into a central location, now what they could do is actively monitor the status of all of these different entities that they're managing.
So say you've just recently started a startup in a space that you've just begun to recognize is extremely complex with different incentives at every level in a way that you've never seen before. Apart from having just a tiny bit of regret, would you go back to school to learn how to solve the problem, or would you just forge ahead and learn as you go? Welcome back to How It's Med, the podcast where we chat with the foremost thinkers, funders, founders, and executives who are shaping the future of healthcare and health tech the world over so that we all can live better quantity and quality of life. This time around, we're rejoining a conversation with Michael Millar, the CEO of Virto Health. Last time, we learned a little bit about what digital twins are, but this time around, we dig a bit deeper into how Michael has executed his play into the healthcare space to allow for more efficient use of healthcare resources, leveraging the technology that his company is built on. Let's get started.
And I guess specifically what I found interesting about your platform is that you've also got someone devoted directly to AI and technology transformation. So the next step in my head is that beyond asking clinicians what data points they want, you can also identify what data points are relevant. So the human step in that is suggesting to clinicians that these data points could be useful. Has that been difficult?
Yeah. It's interesting. It hasn't been difficult because it needs to be iterative, right? So clinicians don't think day to day in terms of data, right? They just do what they need to do to get the job done. And so letting them know what type of data and the nuances and the complexity of getting it is always tricky. But equivalently, you know, behind the scenes, we also have a complexity in that the people who manage the solutions don't actually know the data that well inside them as well. So like if you go talk to a person who runs an HL7 interface for a hospital EMR, you probably would have trouble asking them detailed questions about what data is in the EMR and where it's stored correctly. And so bringing it to your point regarding the AI resource, what we found is technologists know how to manage the data, but they don't know the nuance of the data in it. And clinicians know the nuances of the data, but they don't know where it's stored or how to get access to it. And so the clinicians tell us what we need to look for. And then we know that the technologists can give us key, but they can't guide us specifically to that data. And that's where AI plays a big role in our company, where we're able to say to them, hey, send us the generic feed and our system itself will be able to detect. We have an AI ingestion algorithm that can go through those feeds, find specific nuances of the data. So like, let's say one of the data that we need is a pathology report. Well, that's very hard to find in a stream of everything that is healthcare. And so the AI algorithm, we tell it, these are the key fields that you're trying to find, but map out all the other data that you see as you ingest it. And so our AI algorithm is able to take these large fire hoses of data information that's being sent between systems, classify it into HL7 fire, but also help us find those specific data points that we need to deliver value for the clinical problem that we're trying to solve.
Have those conversations when it comes to identifying not the specifically mentioned relevant data points, but data points that could serve to augment the sensitivity and specificity of whatever findings you have. Have those conversations gone well? And what, I guess, what tools or conversational tactics have you found useful as someone who's not a clinician to converse and convince clinicians that, yes, this data point will be useful and you should integrate it into your system?
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting is the more you go into specialty, the more they know the data, because they are like the lab reports and the information is there. Once you go more generic, so if you're talking about a GP or if you're talking about a nurse, then specific data points, especially in specific disorders, is not as clear. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a problem, I would say, on the data front when it comes to when we're looking at specialized like pathways that we're trying to automate. But one of the things is I think that doctors especially are very data oriented. They do not think in abstracts. They like specificity. And so whenever we show them how our system is able to track a patient through a complex process, they always want to know how and how our system does it. So the interesting thing is once they tell us what process we need to track and we integrate it, they always like going through it and understanding what assumptions that we've made to understand that they're at this phase or this phase, and they want to check it. And the reason why they want to check it is if we're going to automate off of that data, they need to know for sure that's the only state that the patient is there. And so one of the things that constantly impresses me is how much people care about the efficacy of what they're delivering to and the accuracy of what they're delivering to patients. And so if there's any chance of patient harm, suddenly their antennas are up and they go through all the data elements together. But I have found that clinicians actually love understanding the data once we're able to put it in front of them and tell us the rationale, right? And so that's kind of the point that we meet around. They're able to see the data that they create and how we use it to track the patient. And sometimes it's a good conversation because they're like, okay, we didn't really care about how we stored that, but knowing that that's how we're going to track it, we're going to add controls in our process to make sure that we capture it in a standard way. And so often our platform creates a dialogue between the technologists and the clinicians, but it also excites them because instead of data that just gets saved into an EMR, it's data that activates things. And so they feel more connected to what they're storing inside the EMR as they go forward.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Okay. So to zoom back out, basically, now you've kind of overturned this concept of episodic care and kind of replaced it with journey-based healthcare, as you call it, as its successor. But I know this journey wasn't smooth sailing because in 2020, COVID hit. So, I mean, how did that impact your operations? And you told me the story. You've told the interview on TechTO this story. Find it fascinating. So I'd love for you to go through it.
Yeah, no problem. So yeah, when I founded the company, I was looking at complicated journeys like oncology, mm-hmm. chronic disease management, palliative care. Those pathways and those journeys go over years, right? And so a lot of the initiatives that we're talking about is like, how do we help create a journey that helps diabetic patients? We're doing some work with St. Mike's to work on that. But it's funny, in 2020, when COVID started becoming more and more real, in March when it became very real, it was interesting to see how the conversation changed, right? Because we didn't care about it, and then suddenly it's all that we cared about. And so every deal that I had was about these long stage journeys and how you'd manage them. And it is exactly what no one cared about in April 2020. So every single business deal that I was working on basically fell through in March 2020, which was scary. But the belief that I had was that clinicians are always managing some type of journey. They're always managing. So healthcare, even though the opportunities I was working on fell through, it just means that they were focusing on a new type of journey. And this was one of the times where I was really thankful that I oriented our technology not around a problem, but around an approach to how healthcare solves problems. And so healthcare solves journeys, right? So even if you think about encounters are just smaller journeys, right? And so an example that we'll use is like a vaccine appointment is still a journey, right? And the reason why it's a journey is because of how we deployed our vaccines. Vaccines weren't just give it to everyone. It's not just like book an appointment, come in. They trickled in. And we had to focus on the people who were highly, highly at risk. And the people who were highest at risk were 85 plus year olds who lived in congregate settings, right? Lower immune system, congregate settings for easier spread. We saw what happened tragically in long-term care homes. And so that's where our solution, that's when the eureka moment came in, which is, okay, people aren't focusing on chronic disease journeys, but they are focusing on journeys that are relative to the pandemic. So we looked internally, we're like, what are the use cases that we can solve? And we really landed on two. One was COVID testing, so PCR testing. That's a journey where you need the test and you need to know that you're passed in order to know that a clinician can provide care in a hospital. And then the other one was this vaccine journey, which is like, no, you need to know who the person is, what their risk quotient is in order to prioritize appointments for them. And, you know, it's one thing thinking of an idea. It's another thing being able to deploy it. But luckily we had great partners. Our initial partner, Unity Health Toronto now, what it used to be St. Michael's, they had a huge problem. And they were like, oh, the government just told us, find all the 85 plus year old in the community, reach out to them and vaccinate them. And, you know, as a clinician, you know, that's a hard thing to do. Like, how would you even begin doing it? And I'll tell you how these awesome hospitals did it. The VPs and directors got into a room, printed off a list of all the people and started calling. They started calling every one of these 85 plus year old, but a lot of them are in nursing homes. They don't even have a phone number you can reach them at. And so they had like these teams of executives and people at these offices that would stay overnight calling everyone. And, but you know, 40 people can surprisingly not call that many people. If a conversation takes 50 minutes, it means you can reach out to 4 people per hour. So if you have 30 people, you've reached out to 120, that's not going to get to everyone, right? And so they said, is there any way you can help us solve this? And we looked at it and we said, how about if we flip the equation in its head? How about if we look into your repository, find the places where most likely congregate seniors are, and let people there self-register based on criteria? And so we would send these private booking widgets to all these clinical homes. They would identify the 85-year-old, and then they'd have restricted spaces that they can book into. And with that, we immediately changed a 40-person like call center into a 2-person kind of help desk, right? And so, and the best part about it is we more efficiently got vaccines out there. And what our system was able to do is whatever remnant vaccine there was left would make that available to the public. And so the hospitals that worked with us, no wastage, went down from 30-person call centers down to 2 people. That was a simple use of how journeys are powerful, because in healthcare, criteria matters, right? Here's an active service. What your situation is before that is important. That's a journey. That's a micro journey, but it was still something that we're able to develop. And we are so proud to be able to help healthcare organizations in doing that. But we were able to deploy these solutions in like 48 to 72 hours. And that's when everyone started being like, well, wait, this is a secure, externally pen tested solution that you're able to deploy in 72 hours. That normal timeline was probably 12 to 15 months that they would expect normally. And so we got them thinking what is possible, that they can have access to the speed of a new tech without sacrificing the security and the reliance that you expect from healthcare solutions. And I do feel like that message stayed with them. So after we helped them in the pandemic, you know, no one's really interested in that journey anymore. Now a COVID vaccine is just a vaccine. It's just a regular process, right? But it hasn't changed their mind that you can stand up a solution that makes impact in 72 hours. And so once you do that, you create a different conversation with your client base. And that's what we've seen. And it's been great because now we've been invited to many more ambitious, more population health type activities because they know that we can step up and actually meet the challenge.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. Yeah, I'm glad that there's been an impact in terms of how those events have influenced, I guess, hospital executives and clinicians to be more willing to uptake this journey-based mindset into healthcare overall. We focused extensively on digital twins, and there are still two other portions of the product that you have. There's the digital front door, as well as the population health level information. And we're going to dive into those very briefly. So can you tell me more about digital front doors and why you chose to build a digital front door into your tech or for your customers when you already have such a distinctive advantage and product with willing customers in the form of digital twins?
The reason why we saw a need for digital front doors, and really the need for digital front doors is just it's just a health system need, right? Which is and it is related to the pandemic. So the pandemic forcibly accelerated the concept of virtual care. Like, it was not before the pandemic, virtual care was trucking along, but for another 5-10 years, it wouldn't have been a big player, because all health systems were a little bit nervous about making care virtual, because it means that you can't constrain it, right? If you don't virtualize care, you kind of know that a doctor can only meet probably 16 people or 30 people in one day. So, you know, your budget has some certainty. With virtual care, there's no limits. And that's what they were kind of scared of. But the pandemic showed that's not really how patients ended up taking advantage of it. And so now with virtual care being available, now access to care is a big issue, right? So now people can know about certain programs and follow their hospital, know about virtual care programs. But how does a normal person know that these services even exist out there? And so after the pandemic, there was this need to create a way that any person, regardless of their digital aptitude, could find accesses and access services that are virtually supported. And so what we kept on finding is, as we integrated with these solutions, our digital twin would create a very high level understanding of any type of service that that system provided. So our system already was creating these service registries. So we knew about community health, mental health programs. We knew about urgent care programs, nurse practitioners. But if you talk to a person who lived in that jurisdiction, they had no idea that these services existed. And so the natural next step was, hey, can we work with our partners to make it easy for these services to be visible? But instead of, what we found in the market was that there was people who created digital front doors that just social services are there. And there's people who provided virtual care through managing virtual care journeys. And we said, hey, can we just combine those two concepts? So can we take every service that's in a region, make it available on a digital front door, but if that service supports virtual care journeys, immediately transition that person into a virtual care journey. So not only are they finding the service, but they're automatically onboarded into that journey. And that resonated. It resonated in a big way with our clients. And that's kind of what we decided. So it's more, we call it an advanced digital front door, digital twin powered digital front door. Mm-hmm. But the whole concept here is, by bringing all the data together, now we were not only able to bring the right service to the attention of a person who wasn't that digitally savvy, but we could also hand over that information to any new service in a seamless method, so they can find and enroll in one step. And that's kind of like the digital front door opportunity that we saw. And so we've got great partners. They have huge visions. We've got partners like CAMH, Youth Wellness Hubs Ontario. We're doing a rollout of the digital front door in Fraser Health. And all of them, as soon as they do the first step, they're already talking about the second and third, about how can we virtualize the service? How can we change it? And it's so exciting to be a part of that discussion. But that's the digital front door product.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the next obvious step from gathering all this information is to be able to essentially identify and lay out the population health level specific piece of information that are relevant to clinicians, as well as execs, et cetera. And that absolutely is so important to being able to make an impact on healthcare and to make the right nudges at the right time, so we can kind of get out of this hellhole of healthcare that we're experiencing in these days right now. So I wanted to kind of delve a little bit into your thinking about your business model, because you mentioned something about IP on your website, and I don't want to go too much into it if you don't want to, but I wanted to understand your thinking. Was it your business model and thinking that drove the creation of IP, or your IP that drove your thinking towards creating your business model that you're that you've built today?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like a yin and yang. They both influence each other, right? I didn't create Verjo because I could just automate a pathway. My belief was that fundamentally I could use HL7 Fire to create digital twins. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there's two thoughts I had. The first thought was, why does healthcare have so little robotic process automation? And the second thought that I had was, with AI coming to fruition, this was in 2017, what is the biggest limiter in the adoption of AI in healthcare? And the answer to both of them was actually the same, which is healthcare doesn't have a way of defining data trusts and data that it stores. And so what I realized is that I could put the digital twin in place as trusted data. Any data that's in the digital twin has been validated by a clinician, validated through process. And so it's data that healthcare trusts. And as it being data that healthcare trusts, you can automate off of it. You can aggregate it through a digital front door, and you can share it with other people for population health. That was the whole belief. But it doesn't end there. That data can also then be used to drive AI algorithms, right? People don't think about the level of risk in data, but I do because I guess I'm a little bit nerdy. But AI working off of bad data is very dangerous. AI working off of clean data now becomes a risk-controlled AI deployment. And so the ultimate vision that we had was all of this data being able to use, you know, I started the business thinking about robotic process automation. But then what I realized is that the data that I'm creating is not only needed by robotic process automation, but it's being needed by clinicians and population health. And that isn't something I knew when I created the company. But the beautiful thing is, if you try aiming to do something difficult, in the journey of going to that difficult thing, you will find new things. You will learn things, and you will learn different uses and different focuses of your technology. You have to respond to your traction as you go forward. But what's nice to say is the iteration between both of them. The first iteration is, hey, no, I need to be able to support this so it's more visible with patients. And as they did that, I was like, wait a minute, clinicians need access to trusted data because they don't trust the data that they receive in a PDF. And as it iterates, now we're kind of at this point where we're like, wow, the digital twin represents trusted data that can be used to also facilitate the adoption and the embedding of AI technologies in a trusted manner that clinicians control. And that's an iterative vision that I have right now. And I look forward to seeing how it changes over the next 2-3 years. But the ultimate truth is it still validates the same core concept, which is healthcare needs to have a trusted data set that drives what it does. And that's kind of where the digital twin, that's a vision that we came up with, and it's a vision that we're sticking with till today.
Fair enough. And then to close off overall, as someone who came into health tech from a tech-focused background, what are the concrete reflections and key points for any health tech founder to consider, in your point of view, before jumping into digital health tech?
Well, that's good, Fish. I jumped in purely as a technologist. And as a technologist, you always need to check, because you come in with a little bit of arrogance. Technologists think that they can solve everything. What I have learned over time is a business is created by solving problems that the world needs to get solved, right? And so when you have your technology, your initial instinct is going to be, how can my technology, you'll think of it reversely. You'll think, I have a great technology. How do I convince the world that it solves their problems? But what you don't expect is how much the market will influence how your technology develops. And so my recommendation to people is be ready to listen, right? Definitely, in the end, for you to create a growing business, you need to solve a problem that people have. And if you have a great technology, there's just as many companies that fail because the technology didn't solve a problem that people had at that time. And so make sure that the technology that you're creating solves a problem that people have in that time, and it's a problem that the system wants to solve. Because if you create a technology that solves a problem that the system wants to solve, that means you have a market, and that means that you have an adoption path. But if the system doesn't want to solve it, you don't have funding. And if you can't create direct benefit, then you don't have an adoption path. And so I always listen to them. The timing is just as important as efficacy of the solution.
Mm-hmm. And then other than those concrete points, and you mentioned some of them being listening to those who can state the needs straight out, as well as the timing, et cetera, are there any other concrete, pointers or factors that cannot be ignored? So, for example, security.
Yeah. Our team does, because we have so many people who are health informaticians and work in healthcare, we just do it by nature. But healthcare has a lot of, it's very sensitive data, right? Mental health data, procedure data. So their expectations are like SOC 2 compliance, ISO 9001, ISO 13485. You got to know the minimum requirements that you need to work in this space. But if you just do it to satisfy the compliance, it will be technical debt that will drag down your company. What you need to do is create a culture around understanding why it's so important. So people don't think of it as an activity that has to be done, but a concept and a philosophy that they have. Privacy and security are paramount. But on top of that, more concrete things that I would give to entrepreneurs is, don't bog yourself. You need to prove the maturity of your solution as you go forward. So although I'm saying regulatory compliance is important, it also is something that you can graduate into, you can mature into. But definitely when you're creating your business plan, know that if you're going to be serving, if you're going to touch a million health records, regulatory compliance is going to become very important. When you're touching 10 or 15, maybe it's a little bit less important, but it has to be top of mind also as you do it. So yeah, know where you have to be in the maturity of your compliance based on the solution that you provide. And then a second piece of advice is to research. There are many companies who have tried likely doing something similar to you. Understand why they're successful or why they fail, and make sure that you can have an honest talk with yourself about whether or not you have the capabilities and skills and the unfair advantages to overcome those same kind of challenges or barriers that they had to face as they went out.
Mm-hmm. All right. And to finally close off, do you have any pluggables to plug?
Pause. Okay. Yeah. So, I can't think of any plugs right now other than the fact that, we have a lot of, great demonstrations of the technology that we had. We're going to be at the Yale conference in Vancouver, where we're going to be doing a great demo with our partner, Fraser Health. So if you guys are thinking of going in there, please reach out to me. I would love to show you some of the exciting stuff that we've done with our AI-based digital twin deployment in that region.
Awesome. All right. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of How It's Med. If you liked what you heard, the best way to support us is to go to your podcast platform, be it Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever you like, and to give us a rating and a recommendation or a comment so that others can best find us. If you can't do that, then we'd really appreciate it if you could share your favorite episode with those that you care about and who you think would find our work interesting.